I wish I was playing this under better circumstances, but I'm hoping, as we're all joined in whatever your beliefs may be, sending prayers or just good thoughts and, you know, towards Joni Mitchell, who is ailing in a Los Angeles area hospital. Joni's been on our collective minds this week. So I thought, well, today would be a good idea or a good day to play back the one interview that I've ever been fortunate enough to do with Joni Mitchell. I've met her on a few occasions. I got to interview her once, and as I explained earlier, it was an interview for print. I will post the link to the final article on the blog today at RadioOrNot.com so you can read what I wrote based on the interview we did. Now, this interview was never intended to be for air. This interview was for a print article, but we did record it, and then I had the recording transcribed, and from that I wrote the article. But now, I mean, this happened on September 9th, 1998. So, you know, it's almost 20 years ago, right? Yeah. You know, with Joni ailing and us all thinking about her, I thought this is a great day to play this. Now, I got to warn you, it's long. This interview runs over an hour, so the show will run late today, much later than usual, because I'm going to let the whole thing play out. And also, because it wasn't for air, I'm not mic'd. So I put the mic in front of her so I can hear everything she said, which is the important part. But you can still hear me. I'm just off mic. And again, because it wasn't for air, Joni was actually eating lunch while we were speaking. The setting was the Bel Air Hotel. Her album, I think it was Taming the Tiger, had just been released. And so this was a media tour she was doing. And I'm amazed they gave me so much time with her. And again, the article that I was writing this, the magazine I was writing this article for, was called Totally Adult. It was a trade magazine for radio stations like what I used to work at. Some of the trade publications called it adult rock. Some called it album alternative or adult album alternative. Regardless, it was about good radio stations that actually played good music. And when I walked in the room, we just started talking, and we were talking about radio and the station that I had previously worked at in Los Angeles that played her music. And in fact, she did an event for us, a live broadcast we did of a concert she gave at the Autry Museum, the Gene Autry Museum in Los Angeles, because our station was owned by Gene Autry. And at the time of this interview, I was actually working in San Diego. I was co-hosting the morning show on a station called 91X, still there, an alternative station. But the rumors were that there was going to be a new AAA station, adult album alternative station, coming on the air in Los Angeles. So when I flipped on the recorder, that's what we were talking about. Again, it's not going to be the most professional sounding radio interview because, again, this was never intended for air. So it truly is a special edition of our Flashback Friday feature today with the awesome Joni Mitchell. Here we go.
One of the things that I'm hoping for, there's a wild rumor circulating that the company that I'm actually working for now is trying to buy a frequency that's based in Santa Monica. It's Groove Radio. It's 103.1. The rumor is that they're going to buy it and change it to AAA. So that's what Joni and I were just talking about, keeping our fingers crossed that that happens.
But AAA changed. It came out like a good idea and soon became a catch-all for every release. You know, it just became a place to dump,
you know, everything they don't know where else to put.
Yeah.
Right.
Whereas it had an opportunity, I felt, for public service, and that is to eliminate this concept of music as disposable, you know, to keep alive some of the things that maybe weren't exposed a lot to the public, but were worthy of further exposure.
Mm-hmm.
Case in point, you know, suddenly I was on the airwaves again, so I was very happy because I hadn't had an outlet. I didn't fit anywhere until that station came along.
Right. And I know, I remember your comments at the time very, very vividly that, I mean, at the beginning, you were like, great, there's a place my music is getting heard again. And then after about a year or so, and I'm not saying I agreed with the programming philosophy there, I was not the program director, but I remember reading an article in which you were a little critical, and you said, well, you know, they were better when they first started, now they're kind of turning into, I don't think you used the words dumping ground, but basically that's what you're saying, it's kind of like everything else.
Well, album-oriented radio, it meant that they could play any cut. It was closer to the old FM programming that I enjoyed so much in New York. And there was one station out here, B. Mitchell Reed had a show.
Sure.
You know, it was, you know, I missed that kind of radio. It was never as broad as those shows, even the way it was. But at least you could go back and play, they could go back. That's the main thing. As it went along, they weren't going back at all. They were just playing current releases.
Well, we did go back, but it the problem with that station had a few different problems, and one of them was the fight for ratings and differences in opinion at the, you know, management level on what it would take to get that. And
God,
I think we were not true to the ideals that we set out.
Right.
Which was to expose music that wasn't getting heard elsewhere, and that the people who wanted to hear that were going to seek it out with us. I think
their numbers were large.
Well, they were, and in certain places, that's why it would be so great if this happens with Groove, because their signal is based on the West Side, which is where our audience was. And I think if we had stayed true to that ideal that we started out with, we would have done a lot better. And we did okay. It wasn't a question of us not making money. It was a question of Gene Autry just selling the thing. And
how do they find out, like, ratings? I mean, how do they know the idea? How do they know how many people are listening and whether they're buying the product or not?
Well, we don't have anything to do with whether or not they're buying, like, records. But the way that radio stations are rated is the most unscientific, antiquated mythology. They send out diaries. They call people, first of all. They'll call you at your house, say it's dinner time, and you'll answer the phone, and they'll say, hi, we're calling from a company called Arbitron. We'd like to talk to you about a survey on radio listening. Now, if you get, most people would say, no, thank you, click, and hang up.
Right. That's what I do when I get surveyed.
Exactly. As do I. And the problem with this type of radio station is our audience is typically adult, educated, professional, busy, they have a life, and they get a phone call like that, and they say no thank you, and they hang up, if they're even that polite. So, say they get through that, then they say, okay, what we want to do is send you a diary that you will fill out for a week and keep track of your radio listening
for a week.
And anytime you listen in a period of every 15 minutes, anytime you turn on a station for 5 minutes or more, you have to write it down in your diary. Nobody's going to do that accurately. And if they do, it's not going to be kind of audience who's going to do it. So what they do is then they need a certain amount. They need people from each demographic cell. And depending, they flood the city with these diaries for as many people as say will do it. Then they see what they get back. And then they assign a weight to each one so that the demographics of what they get back equal what the census says the demographic makeup of the city is. So it's just a horribly outdated, unscientific method that is not very conducive to this type of an audience.
And it's killing, it means that the best, you know, I don't think the best music could possibly make it onto the airwaves at any given time. You need at the helm, like the old days of radio, people who loved music.
Yep.
And who listened broadly to a lot of different things. The best DJs were very broad audiophiles.
And right now,
and they played what they liked. So that you had a guy who was kind of an expert by his love of music, you know, flooding the airwaves. You know, with all of this stuff, you know, that's when you get, you know, What If God Was One of Us being Song of the Year.
Yeah.
I mean, it's tragic, you know, that Song of the Year, I mean...
I know. And what's really sad, though, is even on a station like this where there, you know, KSCA started up great and it was manned with all these people like me who loved music. mm-hmm. who were into music. And we started out very broad. But then, you know, the consultants come in and the people's like, oh my God, the ratings didn't go up fast enough. They didn't go up high enough, fast enough. So we need to...
Based on these diaries?
Narrow. Because Arbitron is the only game in town, and that's what advertising rates are based on, are the ratings. And the thing that... What happens is, it's the most unbelievable thing. At the stations with the tightest playlists, that play the fewest songs and play them the most often, are the ones that have the biggest ratings. So the theory is, well, in order to get the ratings higher, you have to tighten the playlist and spin the songs more.
That's tragic.
It is tragic. I still believe that a station can do well, but by not doing that, by going against that grain, because people will seek out a true alternative, and they'll go to find the music that they want to hear.
So, like everywhere in the music business, we're building everything off of false measures, and the false measures are leading us into mediocrity.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Very much so. Well, I wanted to ask you about Taming the Tiger. I've been living with it for the last week or so, and then I drove up from San Diego today, and the line jumped out at me about, as the radio blared, so bland, formula music, genuine junk food for juveniles. And I'm working, actually, at an alternative station. The format is known as alternative now, which is, that's exactly what it is. It's sublime, and it's...
But people complain. I mean, you know, and all kinds of people, because my friends are not... You know, there are all different kinds of people. You know, they're thinking type people and they're feeling type people and they're different walks of life. They're not all in the star system and certainly not in show business, you know, necessarily, although most of them can dance. And the lament, you know, across the board is the same. I mean, at the time I was writing it, I was trying to like the radio. And what I did was I started one end of the dial, set it there for a couple of days, and I listened. And I move on to the next. And it just made me madder and madder and madder. And then I get to know color lines. You know, get up there, well, you got a Japanese announcer who said, you know, I just happen to know this, you know, sounds like a black, but he's got an oriental sensitivity.
Mm-hmm.
And you got a lot of slogans like appealing to less violence. And it's still color or oriented. That isn't even living up to, you know, you got Chicano call-ins and a Japanese disc jockey like pretending to be black, you know, like, and but I went down the dial and the formula got to me, like. The evenness of the drum samples, for instance, in certain genres, like the same, like dictated, use this kick drum sound, use this, you have an option of these seven transparent sort of synthetic string sounds, then the chorus and the voices should be up at this level.
See, and you can pick that out because you know what you're listening for, where the average person just knows, you know what, that's familiar and comfortable, I guess. And so it's that least common denominator it's kind of what you're conditioned to, maybe.
Yeah, so you pick your conditioning, but that is not music. You know, music is the dictates of the muse to an individual. Not to say that the great masters of other eras didn't pander. I mean, I ran into this story about Beethoven. Beethoven had a friend who was an inventor, and he invented, among other things, the metronome,
mm-hmm.
right? And he also invented music boxes, quite elaborate, that could duplicate brass band sounds. And they were big brass cylinders that played against little tongues, you know, and quite elaborate composition could be played on them. So he came to Beethoven and he hit him with an idea which Beethoven turned down, and he said, oh, the trouble with you, Beethoven, is you have no sense of showmanship. I mean, if you would just write a piece of music that contained things that were familiar to the people. I mean, the people, they're like, and he's talking about the courts of the people with money, you know, they're like children, you know, they have all this money and they don't know what to spend it on. You know, like if you would just write a piece of music, stick a bit of the French national anthem in it, a little bit of the English national anthem in it, we'll have it performed first in France and then in England, and then we'll put out the brass roller of it and we'll make a mint, I'll cut you in. Beethoven says, oh, I couldn't. Well, anyway, he gets talked into it. you know, and he writes this crapola piece of music, which is a hit. And suddenly he's renowned in France, he's renowned in England. It must have been humiliating to him, so that like, you know, by pandering to the common denominator, by giving them that snippet of the familiar, you know, whereas here is a man driven by the dictates of a muse to make these chords that describe his feelings in the same way that Van Gogh's colors described his feelings, the psychology of looking at those colors side by side, or the psychology of hearing those chords side by side, you know. And this is the only arena in town, because I'm not really a jazzer, I'm not really in anything, so I have to work in this community.
Right. But it didn't used to be like that. I mean, it used to be that artists, and they were artists, could create something that was different.
Yeah.
And that still piqued people's interest enough that it, and these songs could still become hits.
Yeah.
It seems now that that's happening less and less.
You can't even get it through the labyrinth of prejudices unless it adheres to, and it's like paint by numbers. Use this drum sound and use it at this volume and use this and use, I mean, I made this last record by myself, basically, and then brought in guests. But I still had to work with an engineer, you know, and several engineers. And the engineers, they too need to be associated with a quote-unquote hip project because, you know,
it ups their worth,
right?
Sure.
So you see that they're very vulnerable to hip, whereas I could give a damn about hip. You know, like I'm on the I want to throw myself. I know that there's going to be somebody that'll get it, you know. It's not that selfish, really. I'm just going to look for a...
What can I get you?
An ashtray.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, there's...
Can I get you one? Nicole, would you like anything?
I'm fine, thanks.
Okay. Okay, good.
Great.
But
you have the luxury of being established and not needing, you know, to have a hit. You have a following and... People are going to go out and buy your records just because
but not
you're Joni Mitchell.
But not enough. Though I have a goal. It's an ambition. Billboard is supposed to be on my side, like translated, and she wants to be bigger. No, I don't. I've got enough fame. But I want the satisfaction of, like, I want to do an album of standards next.
That would be wonderful.
You know, however, I would like to be paid for it. Now, the only way that, you know, I'm not selling enough records to recoup the cost of making my album, so I keep carrying a debt, which means that I'll never see a record royalty. So I still make money off of writing the songs, because the company hasn't devised a way, although they're trying to get at that yet. Because they're anything to squeeze you, so they can get their goddamn graph to go up the way it is now. You know, you've got these people at the top of the business, and they could care less about, you know, music. All they care about is money. So they're killing music with their goddamn graphs and their Wall Street journals, you know. And they are my natural enemy. They're the enemy of music, and they own the music business.
Mm-hmm.
And they're the devil himself, you know. And in order to make music and keep it pure in this arena, and also to make a living at it, which I feel I'm good enough, I'm an established artist, that I deserve to see a record royalty.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't seen a record royalty on all my Geffen catalog because the records accumulatively cost so much to make, and they were not allowed the airplay, and I can't get my product to market. You know, what I need is to get my product to market and make an announcement that it's out. The prejudice could be chronological age, whatever it is, you know, I have this goal. I want to sell enough records this time, my optimism, to get the debt. The last one won 2 Grammys
mm-hmm.
and didn't recoup the cost of making it. You know, like, the company was shrinking, there was no publicity on it, there was no announce, you know, it meant nothing that it won 2 Grammys.
I'm wondering if maybe it isn't, you know, you have seen this business change. I mean, talk about Geffen from when you started with David Geffen and with Elliot Roberts, and this, it seemed like the camaraderie of it was about the music and it was about the art, to where it's now multi-billion dollar corporations and everything is so expensive and it's about the money and not about the product.
And also a hostile press has come up in the meantime, so that basically this generation of journalists has a love-hate thing with celebrity. Yeah. So the moment that you get a little bit of success, they want to tear you apart. And that, you know, presidents, it's obvious. I mean, this whole thing with the president is absurd. Yeah. You know, it wouldn't have happened if journalism hadn't sank into the pits the way it had. You know, who knows why this generation is so bitter, you know, that they want to tear down everything and have no respect for, you know, to get to the underbelly. Is it the Geraldos? Is it that appetite for seeing people fall on their face? But whatever it is, there is very little dignity left. Mm-hmm. And everything is suspect, you know, to being dissected by ignorant fools. You know, like the whole thing with the president, the moment she sent her address to her mother, you have a blackmailer on your hands, and that she should not be given the public arena or the time of day, let alone to take a man away from serious business when he's got, you know, impending wars and all kinds of things that need his attention, you know. So we wanked off, you know, like, no. I mean...
And you want to say that no other president has done anything like this? They all have, but there wasn't that bloodthirsty press that there is now.
The bloodthirst for the famous. It's not a nice time to be famous at all.
No.
And at the same time, you know, mediocrity is being pushed to the forefront in all fields. You know, is it that they can't tell the difference? Or I don't know. Like, I mean, money... To be moneyed used to mean that you could have the finer things in life. But even if they get money, they don't even seem to know what the finer things are.
It's so, just what's pushed out most in front of them. Well, now, so then my next question would be, with the advent of the internet,
mm-hmm.
and other means of distribution to get things out there, it's now the whole landscape can change.
Mm-hmm.
Record companies don't have the monopoly of distributing music anymore, or over the next couple of years, people will have other ways to get music than just, you know, going to the record store and getting the few albums that the record companies deem fit to push in front of our faces.
Yeah.
Is this something that you could see doing, maybe? I don't know what your deal with Reprise is now, but...
I'm almost out. I've got this and one more record. And
doing it on your own. Make your own record and distribute it yourself or with your own...
It's the way of the future, because the artist is really, like, you know, Prince was going to tattoo slave on his forehead, you know, but we are sharecroppers. I mean, it's absurd. If you look at my early contracts, it's criminal, and then you have all, you know, 30% goes off to the people that supports you. If you have to pay a tremendous amount of money, then the government takes the rest, and then I've been also subject to... unjust taxes based on the fact that I had a clause in my contract which meant that I didn't have to have a producer so that I could keep my art pure and not be forced into it, not slotted. So if anything, like, I'm cutting my economics by choice in order to keep the art pure, working against this system. And I was taxed, a tremendous tax by the government of California. 12 people had that tax levied after them, all of them because they copied this independent-looking clause of mine, right? So, you know, there's been a lot of kind of injustice levied as the greed descended mm-hmm. on my industry. And I would very much like to get out. I mean, I nearly quit. And only the excitement with this new instrument, you know, has kept me in the business. And, you know, as the album reflects, like, a lot of what's going on inside of me is a negative attitude towards my business. Taming the tiger, you know, the tiger being an analogy for the business, you can't tame it, you know. Like, I mean, you know, I'm speaking out against it now, you know. I guess I'm taking a couple of swats at it, but it's a big thing. The only way is independence, you know. Mm-hmm. So the greed of the business, I think, will eventually collapse it. It's like United Artists, you know. The performers will only, you know, take so much, and then finally they go their independent way.
Right.
You know, actors and actresses, you know, if anything, or it goes the other way. They're able to manage to get, you know, more than the lion's share, since so much money is generated in that
mm-hmm.
in that. Industry,
yeah,
you know.
It seems a totally different case with musicians.
We're expected to do charity work for their tax deductions, You know, there's a lot of false charity in the business. We have us by contract to do charity work now in the contracts. Charity is not a contracted idea. It begins at home and with the heart, you know. And so there's a mockery of charity involved in my business, too. I don't think they know what it even means anymore.
That's a shame. It is a shame that music is art, or it started out as art and it has become business, and the art is suffering because of it. Let's talk about the new album for a minute and the, the instrument. What is the instrument?
It's called the VG8. It's basically a box that contains a lot of pre-sampled guitar sounds, kind of from Duane Eddy to Eric Clapton, a couple of Keith Richards, if you want to go that way with it.
Right.
And then you can go inside and you know, there's a sample sound, but then you can open up the box and see what is making it up, and you can alter it with the reverb and what amps it's going through and what kind of a guitar. So I took basically a pre-programmed Stratocaster sound, put it through a jazz chorus, which also was kind of invented for me to double digital delay. If I'm to understand it right, at the time when there were about four boxes you could put a guitar through, a phaser, a wah-wah, there weren't very many effects at that point. I went to a merchant in town and I said, do you have anything you can put a guitar through and make it sound like two guitars? He didn't, but when the Roland representative came, he ran it by him, and a few months later, like 6 months later, they came back with the prototype of the jazz chorus, digital delay, which is used on everything now. And so the first jazz chorus was how I was able to kind of duplicate the double guitar sound on Hegira in performance. So I'm using digital delay, and I'm using a certain amount of reverb on a Strat, and that's about it. But it gives me a big, fat orchestral sound for my guitar, and I can put all my tunings in this box.
That's
the main thing. That you know, a lot of people may enjoy this instrument, but I'm the only one, as far as I know, that needed it. I mean, in order to go on, I needed somebody to invent something that I can go ding, ding, ding that fast from one tuning to another, where it would take 15 minutes to get it in tune, and then the strings are still stretching. So I was always out of tune in performance, which drove me crazy because, you know, I have good pitch, so it saved my life. It saved my musical life, this instrument.
So you can play with one guitar and just change a setting and you're in another tuning.
Yeah.
How, and being just a fan of music and not very musical myself, is this something that is innate to you, that you knew these different tunings, or you experimented, and is it something that just learned?
Well, the standard tuning and the way guitars are built is to Spanish tuning, and it's
right.
Tuned in a certain way. The banjo is tuned a different way, and most of the old black musicians went from banjo to guitar, and nobody told them about Spanish tuning, so they tuned guitars into banjo tuning,
uh-huh.
which is open G. That's what Keith Richards plays in. And in the VG8, Keith Richards' two slots are actually five strings, like a banjo, with a sixth string removed in open G tuning. And that's what all the Rollings, that's what I think he plays in most of the time. So that tuning was known in coffee houses because of the black blues players.
Mm-hmm.
Then there was a D modal, where you take your top strings and drop them down from E's to D's, and it gave you a kind of a modal sound. That was kicked around, and then just, there were about three tunings that were known. But I started as a piano player. As a young child, I wanted to be a composer. I heard beautiful melodies in my head and loved classical music, and had friends who were baby classical musicians who went into adjudicated competition and were quite precocious. And you know, I was the painter, so I was just kind of the sidekick to all of this. But I absorbed a lot of competitive classical music, attending their performances, and began to kind of dream of playing the piano beautifully well, took lessons, got my wrist slapped for wanting to play by ear and quit, and came around to folk music as a hobby just for pin money in art school, no intention of making a career of it. And all this repressed talent didn't really come out until I began to write my own songs. My own songs were, if you listen to the first album, it's much more like German Lieder, you know, than it is like folk music. It's very more like classical guitar. already I'd gone into the tuning family. Then as my ear got more and more modern, or, quote, more and more jazzy, depending on how you look at it, you know, color juxtaposition, like painting the chords that I wanted to describe. Like, some of my text is pretty sad, you know, like, if you just used minors with it, to me it would be kind of slit your, it would sound like the Smiths, it would be like, which is like downer, you know, not to be, you know, but like the Beat of Black Wings is a really tragic song, but the music is very light, so that you create irony as opposed to melodrama. There's a, you know, so in order to, because of the very dramatic nature of my writing, to prevent melodrama, which I abhor, which gets very high ratings, you know, like the chords had to become more symphonic to underscore, and they had to be appropriate, you know, like to the text, you know. But to a lot of ears, it's just Joni's weird chords. So there's a lot of people who can't really perceive my art.
From your background as a painter, it sounds like you see the music visually.
Yes. Yeah, very graphic. Yeah. But not by the normal staff. You know, I see it more in terms of color and line, painterly line, you know, like I want the line to enter here, you know, and I want it to get out here. When I play with other musicians, like Wayne Shorter, for instance, I cut him loose on 12 tracks and just let him scribble everywhere. But then I edit him, and I know, like, I want, you know, something to come in here. And I take what I think are the most beautiful scribbles that he did across this thing, and some of them are just genius. I mean, they're just splendid that he could lock into the design that astutely, you know, like my own hand, you know, so that you don't get, it's collaborative, but it meshes together like classical composition.
Uh-huh. And that's when it's art, and that's when you feel it.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
Back full circle, that's kind of what's missing in a lot of the music. I always say that one of the marks of a truly great song is when it elicits a physical response in you, and maybe it is when it does hit a different sense, like you can visually see the music as art, not in terms of notes on the page, but
like Wayne Shorter's solo on Facelift in the bridge, to me is just it's genius, and I don't use that word. I stammer to use it. Michelangelo was a genius, I always say, you know, genius is bandied around too freely, but and the funny thing is that he said something to me. He's a trained musician, Berklee School of Music, that they were taught at Berklee School of Music never to go from a sus chord, never to stay on a sus chord, a suspended chord, very long, and never to go from a sus chord to a sus chord. Well, I was taught in art college about, you know, a little later in time than he went to music college, you know, never to use colors of the same intensity, because they'll create a vibration. Well, psychedelic poster art came along. Also, I was taught that there was a distinction between commercial and fine art, which Andy Warhol broke down shortly after I, you know. So the rules are generally, most of them are broken, that they would still be standing. I don't really know what a sus chord is, but I know that I like chords that have an unrequited or an open-endedness to them, which I suspect is a sus chord, and that my tunings, I suspect, are sus chords, and I'm barring, so I'm going from I'm staying on a sus chord, going to a sus chord, and adding in another one, and a lot of people don't like that. But to me, it sounds fresh, and also, my life is in suspension. Those chords, you know, depict the way, you know, there's been some resolution in my life. My child was returned to me, right? You know, there's an occasion to get back to some good old-fashioned majors, right. You know. But all my life, between the bomb hanging over me and my child being out there somewhere, there's no wonder I like chords that have a second running through them all the way. And that's, I guess, that's the deadly sus chord, perhaps, that you're not supposed to go from one to the other. But my life was in suspension. So if you're listening to the dictates of a muse, it's not like if I broke that rule, it wasn't to break it for breaking its sake. I didn't really know what a sus chord was, or I didn't know the rule, but I knew that movement, when I listened to it personally, was a depiction of how I felt.
And And you've always seemed to do that anyway. You're going to follow what feels right to you rather than the rule someone tells you, well, this is what you're supposed to do, because I don't think you really followed that.
Yeah, it's an artist's ego. You know, and because an artist is a solitary person and used to standing back and judging themselves, there's no one there. You know, like, I mean, if you, art school can kill that in you, but you need to stand on your own judgment, you know. So that's one reason why I've never wanted a producer. You know, I figure, gee, you know, did Mozart have a producer? No, you have to judge what you're trying to get at yourself. And
well, it's your production, just like your painting is.
It's composition,
right.
Really, more than production. You know, production, again, is the idea of us as produce going to the marketplace.
Right.
It's not. It's composition.
So your daughter was returned to you.
Yeah.
Now, I guess I did a lot of reading. No, I mean, I've been a fan of yours for so many years, but knowing that I was going to talk to you, I went through the internet and just pulled articles from throughout the years, from different eras, just to see the, you know, the how attitudes were different, or, you know, the fact that you had a daughter was not known until somebody talked to an old college roommate.
My roommate at college, who also was an unwed mother and should know the stigma at that time and
right.
the disgrace of it, sold me to the Inquirer for a personal gain.
Oh my God.
That's how it started.
That you lost touch with?
Occasionally we have reunions, like, you know, not mostly for the dance crowd. She attended my 50th birthday,
mm-hmm.
and that, it was right about after that, like many of the women that I grew up in, there's a resentment that I could come from where I came from and quote unquote make it. You know, I kept a couple of good men friends all my life from my hometown. But most of the women resented the fact that I went out into it and, you know,
uh-huh.
and made it. I don't know if it's a colonial attitude or...
I think it's a female thing. I think it's a catty female.
Yeah, you
thing.
See it in sitcoms. Like the but usually when the successful one comes, she rubs their noses in it.
Right.
You know, like I didn't rub... You know, if anything, I'm placating them all the time because all of their little achievements, you know, like... I understand, you know, I never wanted to be a star, you know, so the thing in our community was to have your own business and have a cottage at the lake, you know, that's a beautiful, I understand that, so if they have a cottage at the lake, they'll go, of course, it's not like a mansion in Malibu, right, so always they're measuring themselves against this stuff and hurting them and then being mad at me, so it was difficult. I'm managing to, like, through repetition to get them kind of used to me, and by reminding them I haven't forgotten them, you know, by reminiscing, say, I don't know what they think, you go away and you completely cut yourself off from your roots, turn your back on it, you know, you can't, it's in your blood.
So she went out and sold a story to the Inquirer, and I haven't been there, but I can only imagine that. You know.
It was very painful. And then the New York Times picked it up and they dropped the name of Calgary in it, and Calgary got all full of themselves because their name was in the New York Times. You know, this is a really small colonial crop, you know. And then they went exploring around and found a picture, you know, asked around to see who I went with in art school, and, you know, managed to find and suck the father into all of this. And, you know, all of it in the final wash, you know, I always mean to call Lori and say thank you. You know, you meant to do, you know, just because after the initial pain of it, it sped up the processes, and it probably, I don't know how long it would have taken. There's no way I can find Kaloran. She would have had a hard time finding me without this. So no doubt.
Have you been looking for her?
I tried. I you know, I went to Toronto right around the time of the Ethiopian things. There was an Ethiopian concert up there, and there was a nun who used to conscript me to do charity work for her. She was very forceful. I'm not Catholic, but I'd go and play for depressed people. Her nuns, she wanted me to be a nun. She wanted to conscript me. She thought, she likened me to, what's that guy's name? He was a Protestant, that Merton. Anyway, he was a very original Catholic thinker and a good priest, you know, like a fresh tributary into Catholicism. and the son of two painters that traveled around the world. So we had, but anyway, she thought I was, you know, she wanted to conscript me and was always after me. So I thought, well, I kind of, you know, not that I keep score, but maybe she would help me because I've done some things for her. And I attempted to do it, but things conspired because in Toronto, where I had my daughter, two or three people knew, and those two or three people had big mouths. And so, you know, the legend as it blankets that particular zone. When I was in town that time, a boy came up to me at a table and said, you know, my daughter or my girlfriend really loves you. Oh, thank you, I said. You know, I mean, no, she really loves you. I said, well, tell her thank you very much. Her name's Kelly. I said, oh, that's a pretty name because I named my daughter Kelly. But I didn't think of it at the moment. He said, Kelly, and he leaned into it, and I said, oh, how old is she? And he told me, and I said, well, you tell her that she's too old. So at the time that Kalornan, you know, was looking for me, which this article helped, sped things up by 5 or 6, maybe 7 years, there were 30 other girls claiming me. So there was a sorting process that had to be done, and... But she's my kid, all right.
Wow. Is that the most amazing
thing? The most amazing thing.
I can imagine.
Yeah, just
wonderful.
Really fulfilling.
So I don't want to tread where I don't belong, and I don't want to get too personal, but this must have opened up a whole other floodgate of emotions and experiences. And
oh, yeah. That's, we're finding, like Stay in Touch applies, although... It wasn't written specifically. It's almost prophetic because it applies very well, you know, to this kind of a union, because it's I'm sure that there will be or maybe even have been books written on it, but I've seen two movies on it. They're Secrets and Lies and Flirting with Disaster.
Right.
You know, I watched them with Kaloran. She nearly fell asleep, and it was. She likes comedy. She loves comedy. So Flirting with Disaster was more interesting to her because it had more humor to it. But the balancing is difficult in the first. We had one major kind of altercation in the process of getting to know each other, in which I had to confer with her father, and you know we had a kind of a. It's hard without telling the whole scenario for me to capsulize all of this, but we came through all of it, made us all closer. You know, there are difficulties coming out of the blue, and especially with me being, you know, in the position that I am, being a public person, it kind of a shock. Although Kaloran was a model from 14 to 27, and so she had been around the world, and she'd had her own taste of celebrity, and that all helped. You know,
she inherited the artistic.
She's a painter.
Wow.
And a swimmer. Yeah.
Wow.
And she loves to paint, so she's got that drive.
Mm-hmm. You're a painter. You're a musician and a singer and a poet and a dancer.
But I never really exploited that.
And I read somewhere, it was, I guess you saw a show that was a tribute to your music. It might have been the drag thing
mm-hmm.
in New York. And you said that you enjoyed it, but wanted to, like, get in there and take some control. And I don't know if it was direct, if that was the show, or if it was a different show you were talking about.
No, definitely John Kelly. I sat, like, I desired no control. No, I went expecting to be lampooned, and instead I was very moved by the whole thing. Some of it was just an homage more than, you know, he had some of me down all right, and I liked his costume changes, and even my rambling narrative style, he had somehow or other managed to emulate, but in his own way. So what I saw was a kindred spirit who loved my music, and you know, he sang Shadows and Light in full tenor, you know, in Joni drag, you know, from his heart, and I cried my eyes out. No, there was nothing I would have changed or directed in it at all. I was truly honored, and the audience was a New York audience, and they're so cool, you know, And at the end, they kept going, you know, flicking their bicks and throwing flowers and responding like my audience to him and ignoring the fact that I was there. One person in the audience kept checking me out to see what my response to was, but everybody else ignored that I was there until the very end. We gave him two encores, and my boyfriend called out, "We love you, Joni," and he blushed because he knew where we were. He knew who was. And then when the encores were over, the audience stood up and faced where we were sitting, and only then did they acknowledge that I was there. So it was very, very moving.
Wonderful.
It was a wonderful experience. And no, I don't know what that would have been. I'm doing a TV show that I want to take control of because I try to keep it from being a cliche, and
what,
I feel...
What is this?
I'm about to go up and edit. So I did a TV show that I think, you know, I would love to designate duty if people would not revert to formula.
Is this like a concert special?
Or, yeah.
For VH1? Or?
I don't know where they're going to sell it everywhere. Pay TV initially and then BBC, CBC, and I don't know what the American market is yet. I think that there's a trade show coming up, and that remains to be seen where they'll place it in terms of America. But no, I
think what I was getting at was, and I don't know what it was in relation, that something you said, I don't remember, and it doesn't even really matter. What I was going to ask about is whether or not, you mentioned you want to do an album of standards, which I think is, I'd love to hear.
Yeah, I just want to be a singer. Okay, nothing
right.
else, just sing.
But if you'd ever, because you are a dancer, if you would ever entertain the thought of a Broadway show or something like that, of writing a musical and choreographing it and just expanding in that arena?
Well, I never really, I was a Lindy dancer. I was a partner dancer in high school. Mainly that was the dance. And it was, you know, I was good on a small town scale, and I lived for it, and I loved it. I mean, I loved it with a passion, the same passion that I then applied to folk music. Like, and all my dancing friends, suddenly, like, I'm this, you know, it was almost like schizophrenia to them. One guy said, Anderson, that was my maiden name, if you don't put that guitar down, it was a ukulele, you know, I'm going to break it against the wall. You know, because when I got it, I took all the energy that I put into dancing, and I'd huddle in the corner at parties and go in and romance this box with strings on it, you know. So it developed. My inner life had been kind of secretive. I wrote poetry always, but didn't like poetry. Never showed it to anybody unless I had to turn it in on an assignment. And I just, rhyming Joan, I was taught to rhyme almost in infancy by a Cockney woman, you know, so rhyming came easy to me, and I put my thoughts down in rhyme because it was structured, you know. But I never really liked poetry. I always thought that there wasn't enough meat on it. Mm-hmm. When I read Nietzsche, and he felt that way about it, you know, because nobody ever knew what he was either. Was he a philosopher with poetic bent, or was he, you know, a poet with a philosophical bent? But he was very hard on the poets. And I laughed when I read the things he said, like horrible things about them, you know, and all, in my opinion, true. And the, you know, I, like he, wanted to make a new brand of poetry that had more... It was more cinematic, I guess, you know, like in my, you know, like my one of my favorite compliments came from a black hairdresser at the last year's Grammys. You know, she came up and she said, "Girl, you make me see pictures in my head." And I said, "Okay," you know, because poetry is too vague for me for the most part. And you like, it's almost like I'll hift itself or something, and you're digging, and you know, I don't have the time to go digging around and find out there was nothing there in the first place. And I just was hugged. It was a shaggy dog story, you know, like about light on a leaf or something, you know, like, I like haikus, and but I never could get into Ode to a Daffodil and some of that stuff in school, you know. I love flowers. But somewhere that needed more meat to it, me.
No, I know what you're saying about poetry. I'm the same way. Lyrics to songs move me. I'm not one who can open a poetry book and read it. It's a very rare poem that will grab me.
Yeah.
In itself.
Yeah, you can always feel the poetic stance or something, like the effort to be poetic or... You know, I mean, I'm saying this as someone who writes this stuff, you know, but again, my prejudices are many, but they're the lines of my creativity. That's why I don't really like to get into what do you think of so-and-so or anything, because I'm so hard on what I think is good, and I don't want it falling, bad enough I can take it myself, because I do it to myself, you know, like I've set these enormously high standards for myself, you know, to strive towards.
Right. But you haven't explored the dancing part of your...
Well, you know, my girlfriend Ola, Slash's mother, was a dancer, and I ran into her in the streets of Paris about 10 years ago, and she'd gone at 40-something and joined a Paris dance troupe and got back to her dance, and I thought that was kind of amazing at 40-something. At 55, you know, like, I mean, I doubt that I'm going to, you know, turn into Isadora Duncan or anything, but with the revival of swing dancing and with a group of friends who are blessedly younger than me and good dancers, some out of the pauper camp, you know, and some out of show dancing and ballet, you know, it's our intention to start going out dancing more often, more for fun. But I should sometimes... See, I've never been allowed to do videos either. You know, that's another thing, that they wouldn't play my videos. I put up my own money and made my own videos to prove. I thought, well, the record company thinks that I'm middle-aged and, you know, but I can pull off youth on camera, or I could at that time. You know, now it's a little harder. But, you know, like, but I still, you know, I'm an energetic old bird, you know, like, but that outlet was never allowed me as a form of expression, which is kind of a shame, you know. It was just, the door was closed.
And it is a shame, and that should have been something if that's a standard thing. However, then you're running up against the MTVs and VH1s of the world, which are
the same old problem.
Radio,
yeah,
because the outlets are fewer. Janet Jackson sampled Big Yellow Taxi, and did she approach you about that, or?
Yeah, she asked my permission. We spoke on the phone, and yeah, I was honored, and I loved the record. I like dance music. I like that, and it distinguished itself, I think. If you listen to that radio station, which I did for several days, and it wasn't just because I was a participant in it, it was outstanding in its conformation. I loved the groove. It stood out among, thematically, it stood out. I was really proud of it.
I was amazed when I heard it. I thought it sounded great.
Did you see the video?
I never saw the video.
The video was my favorite video ever. It was really casual. It had a look of, it was sepia with color in it, like old magazines.
Uh-huh.
It was very, very, the spirit of it was very dignified. The men looked like men. The images were very African, teeming with humanity. The video was teeming with humanity and a quiet dignity. And Janet was radiant and very ethnic, with cornrows,
mm-hmm.
and a warm presence in it. It was a great sense of activity and inactivity. I can't explain it, but basically it came from somebody's photographs, I believe, that were taken in South Africa, maybe in the 40s or 50s. So the men were wearing hats, but they're ceiling fans. And their image is like a guy with a parrot on his arm and a bunch of black kids up on a billboard with a big black head. I only saw it once, so I don't remember whose face, whether it was a political face or whether it was important or whether it was just selling toilet paper or what, you know. But just all these kids huddled at the, you know, like leaning down over a billboard, so... the images were candid looking.
Mm-hmm.
A woman washing her hair, another woman doing that big bum African dance, like where you stick your bum way out and you rotate it in circles. squat toilets. Yeah.
So with the TV special that you're doing, are you experimenting with any of this kind of stuff? I mean, would you want to branch out into directing something like this, or because you're obviously very creative and think in such a visual.
Well, I've never had any budget, so most I've done all my videos up until this show. Anything that was visual, I edited myself,
mm-hmm.
and you know, and on a really low budget. So, and the videos that I did, I flew to Tokyo and I sold $120,000 worth of paintings. The only time I've sold. And turned it all back into videos, the Beat of Black Wings being one of them. in which I play a black man, you know, I wanted to show I can act, which is, you know, and the record company looked at it 4 times and didn't realize that it was me, you know, like so nobody ever saw any of this stuff, so they just kind of sat in the can. It was kind of a waste. It was a waste of, you know, I spent a lot of money, and I thought if I could prove it to them that then they would get behind it with the record, but the doors were closed, so nobody ever did anything, and I proved nothing. It was just another, you know, economic loss and a source of frustration. You know, almost like, I kept thinking about Elvis, you know, Elvis could act, and they kept putting him in those cornball B-movies, and he was dying, because he was so much more intelligent than that. You know, this was, in its own way, you know, another kind of waste of talent.
Mm-hmm. Any plans to do any art exhibits? I saw one, right when Turbulent Indigo came out, they had a little record release party for you in Santa Monica at that little gallery and showed your paintings.
Overnight, yeah. I have fly-by-night exhibitions.
Yeah. Is any plans for a major show?
I hadn't, you know, like one of the things when we were trying to figure out how to promote this album, since, again, I used a lot of the paintings on it, was to try and organize a traveling show, like of museums or something across Canada. But museums booked about 2 years in advance. So you really had, and it's a lot of work to mount an exhibition, and you have to appear and hang it. I wouldn't let anybody else hang it, you know, because sequencing is also an art form, would be sequencing an album. That's why I like editing film, you know, because I like sequential problems and fancy myself to be good at it.
Charles Mingus sought you out to collaborate with on his final work. Is there anybody that you know of, a young talent, somebody you think is artistic and creative and talented that you would like to work with, that you would want to collaborate with?
Well, the only thing, not so much young, I'd like to produce Wayne Shorter, mainly to not produce him, just to give him his full lead, you know, so that he doesn't get produced. Same thing Crosby did for me on my first album, you know, to pretend to produce him, so to speak, to give him his lead, because I think he gets, you know, and I also know his talent very well, I think, at this point, and would be, you know, where selections need to be made, I think I can judge what is his best work, you know. But no, I can't think. I'd like to do some more of that, like take old music of mine and turn it into dance music. Mm-hmm. That kind of intrigues me.
Uh-huh.
You know, to pull slogans, to pull the sound bites out of the old tunes, the hooks, you know, sort of like the Janet Jackson thing. I got a thrill out of that, you know, if it's well done, like that, I believe, was. There's another group, too, that's been sampling me that they took a piece, a guitar loop from I Had a King and another one from Sweetbird, I think, or something anyway, but yeah, in that way the recycling of old stuff that appeals to me, but no, I can't think of a young artist that I've seen yet. That I mean, there's a lot of artists I like Bjork's talent. I think she's an original, you know, that she's got a fresh approach.
Excuse me, Nicole, how are you doing on time?
Good. Another, like, 10 minutes or so?
Yeah, that's fine.
Great.
There are things that I hear that I think are pleasant, that I like a song here and a song there, you know, for my own personal enjoyment, like, environmentally, when I'm out, I can enjoy a lot, you know, of found music, because it's everywhere, mm-hmm. You know. But when I'm looking for musical inspiration, no, it's not an inspiring crop, and mainly because they're being over-directed, I think. Left to their own devices, making their own judgments, you know, would increase the, you know, if you turn it over to somebody else and leave the studio and let them build your tracks for you and all of that, you know, like, I'm not a fan of processed music in the long run. I wouldn't own an album, but I could. But some of them turn out nice in spite of it, mm-hmm. you know. And I could say that's a pleasant song.
Are you familiar with Patty Griffin?
No.
She just released her second album, which is with the full band. But it was right before KSCA went off the air, and this little record came across my desk. Actually, I'd heard about it from a friend, and it's just her with a guitar. Living with Ghosts is the name of the album. It's the first one she did, and what they decided, she did some demos with the full band, and they said, go back to the originals. And it was just her with the guitar, and it's some of the most beautiful music. She had a terrific voice, and lyrically, it's just tremendous. And now she put out a record with the full band that rocks, and it's actually quite good. But I still love that first record she did. I think you might like it.
One of the most exciting things that I heard was on the first Deep Forest mm-hmm. album was The Pygmy. The most sophisticated, heartfelt, gorgeous pitch, gorgeous compositional sense, a rondella, so to speak, you know, unbelievable, pierced my heart, just made me feel, a lot of contemporary singers don't touch me, either it's gotten like opera, you know, either they're singing in a tradition, and the tradition, the tones, a lot of the tones of the females are either shrewish or whiny, or they have false coming in their voices, like catches in their voices that are supposed to sound sexy, but they put them on articles and things like that. So I couldn't really stand to listen to contemporary singing, you know, between the black affectations of the males, whether they were from Australia or England, mm-hmm. you know, or the whining or the shrewishness or the false eroticism of the females, you know. But Deep Forest, which was a roundup, you know, of people who aren't in show business, you know, who probably pray, a lot of them, before they raise their voice, you know.
Because there was a genuineness there.
Yeah, that's all I got, so I could listen to them and the Sons of the Pioneers. Uh-huh. That's why I ended up covering that one, because they were my favorites when I was a preteener, uh-huh. In terms of vocalists.
Uh-huh. You did the short West Coast tour with Bob Dylan and Van Morrison.
Mm-hmm.
I was at the last one, at the Anaheim Pond Show, which was just such a wonderful night. I just want to know about that, how it went.
I got really sick. I coming out of Vancouver, we took a bus to the Gorge, and they had glued the carpet down with some kind of really stinky mm-hmm. glue. And I don't know whether it was that. And also there was air conditioning. And it was a long ride, about eight hours. But when I got off the bus, the whole roof of my mouth was inflamed and my throat. It looked like an allergic reaction, which made the rug kind of suspect. But it was diagnosed as a virus. And he gave me penicillins, which I had a radical reaction to. And I lost my motor functions for part of a day. So I had to hole up what was to be a travel day. Blessedly, the worst of, you know, I did the two Gorge dates in a state of delirium. Then the following day, I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't chew and I couldn't walk. I was eating and I had to tell myself, chew, walk, you know. And so we called a doctor, a Chinese doctor, and he said, you know, that I was toxicity from the medicine. I was having an allergic reaction to that. So the San Jose concert, I apologized to my audience. I don't remember it. All I knew was, by that time, if I hit a high note, I felt like I was going to black out. So all the way up until the very last concert, I was really behind the wheel. Bobby had bronchitis, and he's allergic to air conditioning and fluorescent lights too, which the halls are full of. So he sat mostly in a blackened truck, and Van came to me at one point and said, you know, has he spoken to you? I said, yeah, we talked in Vancouver. And he said, well, he hasn't spoken to me, you know. I said, well, come on, let's crash his show. So we went on this one song just as a kind of a lark at the Gorge, and, you know, looking at the faces of the people, loved it. Looking at the reviews, you know, some criticized it and some loved it. You know, it was controversial. But we were going to do, I think it was the last show, the one that you went to, that we had planned to do it again and actually rehearsed that day with Bob's band, because he wanted to do it this time in my set. And we rehearsed and prepared for it, but it didn't happen. So he's an enigmatic character. And also, you know, he saves his stamina pretty much for the show, I think. But but it was a great triple bill. And,
wonderful.
You know, it was hard. Most people thought, I think, if they thought I wasn't giving it my all, they attributed it to restiness, you know, or like not having been out of the chute for so long. But in fact, I was like really, really sick.
Oh, God. Well, it didn't show the night that I saw it. The end of the...
Yeah, that was... I was starting to come out of it, man.
Will you be touring for Tame Impala?
I don't think so. It's my instinct to go into the studio right away because this album has been held back a year by the company, pretty much. You know, I'm behind, way behind schedule, and I want to cut an album of standards,
right.
And I'm excited to do that right now. So I think I'm going to go straight back into the studio. And then I'd like to tour... you know, with symphonies.
Wow.
Because I got a taste on the Stormy Weather Review of singing standards with a big band, and there's been so much controversy about my music. They love it, they hate it, you know. I'm sick of white boys saying that there's no melody here and it's too jazzy, you know. Like, I just want to break from it for a while. I'm going to sing old standards, just be a singer.
Any songs picked out?
Stormy Weather, mm-hmm. A Marvin Gaye song, Trouble Man, those are the two I've been doing. A couple of Billie Holiday things, some Gershwin.
Right.
I'm combing repertoire now, looking for stuff.
Terrific. I wrote down all these notes and I just want to make sure I'm not... What do you think of the whole Lilith phenomenon?
Well, you know, I think for some reason, in a male-dominated business, the whole business seems to be surprised that women can do that kind of box office, you know. I didn't see the show, so I can't really comment on it.
How was Woodstock?
It was wonderful.
Was it?
It was wonderful. It didn't rain during my set. It was precipitous. It threatened. It was a very warm audience. And, you know, coming down the coast, the criticism that was levied against me again and again and again was that I didn't do my earlier material and that it was too jazzy, right? Well, when I got to Woodstock, there was a banner about 8 feet long that said Joni's Jazz and all these heads like up above it. So it was like, you know, and they applauded my players when they, because the musicians I'm carrying, you know, are of a fine caliber, and they responded to them beautifully. They didn't seem to have any problem with the music. No, it was really a thrill. And my daughter and my grandson were there, and my daughter said it was the best day of her life. So, you know, and there was some trepidation, you know. In some ways, I think she'd rather that I was fat and lived in a trailer park, you know, than to land in on all of this, you know, until we adjust, because the press, you know, ate us alive initially, and to come into this carnivorous world. So it was the first time that she'd seen me perform, and she was probably worried that she might not like it, you know.
Uh-huh.
After all, it's your mother.
Right.
You know, like,
How old is your grandson?
He's 5.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
So you kind of get to enjoy the little child aspect.
Yeah, and he was 3 when we met, and he's growing into a little boy, so, yeah.
Oh, that's so great. Oh, I'm so happy for you.
Yeah,
it is.
You
know, driving up here, I had a 2-hour drive. Before I even get to that, that'll be the last thing I ask you about. I just moved to San Diego a few months ago, but I bought my first house 2 years ago in Laurel Canyon. And all I could think of when I was like buying this house, because I love that area, it still has
mm-hmm.
this magical feel to
it. It does, and the smell of it, all the eucalyptus.
Yes.
It's got its own odor, Laurel Canyon.
And I would tell people, my family's in Florida, and I would say, if you were helicoptered and blindfolded and airdropped into my house, you would not know that you were in the middle of LA.
Yeah, that's...
You think you're in the mountains somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It's quiet, it smells good, it's peaceful, you hear the crickets, you hear the squirrels.
The houses are cottagey, they're not real houses a lot of times.
Cottage that was built in 1920.
Yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
It was just, and you know, I always joke, I say, well, I'm one of the ladies of the canyon then.
Yeah.
And one of the fantasies I had that I never did was to like do a documentary on the musical history of Laurel Canyon. And I'm just,
or the history the history and that being part of it. Because mm-hmm. when we first moved out from New York, Geffen and Elliot and all of us and David Blue, kind of we came out in a herd. We all moved on to Lookout Mountain. And Joel Bernstein, I don't know if you know who he is, he's kind of the court historian. He works with Neil Young now. I think he's putting together Neil's box set. But he photographed all of that canyon scene. I brought him out from Philadelphia. He was a fan of mine that used to follow me around. He was 15 with braces on his teeth, but he took good pictures of me. So when I got my record deal, I plucked him out of college to come and photograph me. And he never went back. But he found he's kind of an egghead, and he found an old book that said, ask anyone in America where the craziest people live, and they'll tell you in California. Ask anyone in California where the craziest people live, and they'll say L.A. Ask anyone in L.A., and they'll say Hollywood. Ask anyone in Hollywood, and they'll say Laurel Canyon. Ask anyone in Laurel Canyon, and they'll say Lookout Mountain. So there we were all along this line. Well, at the time that we arrived, Tom Mix's house, which was across from Houdini's house, was occupied by Frank Zappa, and my house looked down on Frank Zappa's pond, which had ducks on it, which I drew on the back of the cover of Ladies of the Canyon. The view in my skirts is across the street, looking up to Wonderland Avenue, I think, going up the hill, and that house with the turrets on it, Chaka Khan occupied at one point, and looking out my window, there was a pond. I got really sick at one point. My mother came to visit. She looked out the window one day, and there were all these white ducks going around, and, you know, Zappa's groupies, like, completely nude, floating around on the raft, you know. So there was, and in the spring, there were cherry blossom trees that I looked at. It was like a Viewmaster reel to look down out of my dining room onto this pond with these ducks. But eventually, it kind of suffered and fell into decay, you know. But the house that I had was charmed. It was just a tar paper roof kind of cottage built by a black piano player in the 20s, but it was really, really a charming place.
Now, does Ron Stone live
there? He did, for he raised his family there and wanted to buy it from me, because if you've ever lived in it, it's charmed. It's, well, apparently there's an Indian burial ground next to it, and I never felt any bad vibes at all, but a friend of mine who's a saint, you know, like a drummer, mm-hmm. who belongs to a certain order with a great sensitivity to the dead. We went there because I have a new tenant that wanted to put in a new stove, and we went to visit him. And as we turned the corner, Jose, he said, his brother, Javier, said, Joni, look at Jose's arms. And all the hair was standing up, and he said, there's a graveyard around here somewhere. And we were approaching. I said, look, don't worry about it. Whatever it is, yes, the property has a very, very strange karma to it. You know, it's like, but it's benign. You know, it's not dark.
Right.
It's protective of this particular plot of land. There was a fire. My neighbors burnt their house to the ground, and I was on the road. But a friend of mine saw the fire and stopped. And while he watched, late summer, with the grasses all dry and everything, the fire billowed, burnt the house 6 feet away from mine, because, you know, they're kind of close together. We were hooked to the same plumbing. These three people built at the same time for party houses to escape the summer heat. And, it burnt, it charred my door, broke my windows, bubbled my paint, and caught on the roof, and was just about to take off and burn my house down when the wind shifted radically and blew it all the other way. When the stones were in there, there was a dead treehouse in the backyard, and one night in a high wind, it went and it snapped at the root. It had been dead, like it was dying, when I inherited the house. There's an old picture of Judy Collins and I up in this treehouse. And I think it still had a couple of leaves on it, but while I was there, it went completely barren. And one night in a high wind, it snapped, and it went to fall on the baby's room. It would have gone through the roof, you know, but the wind shifted at the point of the break and threw it against the break in the opposite direction. So anyone who ever lived in that house experienced that something protects that spot.
Do you still own it?
Yeah. I'm scared to sell it. Ronnie wanted to buy it, but somehow or other, you know, I always think the business being as treacherous as it is, my taxes would be peanuts. I paid $36,000 for it. You know, if everything else fails, I'm going back in that house, you know. It's a great house for a little old lady, and my upkeep would be minimal. I would be able to afford it, even if they robbed me again like they did in the 80s, you know, like, I would still have so it's my safety valve, kind of.
So who lives there now?
Friend of Ronnie Stone's, an associate, an Englishman, and his family.
Okay. I talk to Ron every once in a while. So I know you need to go. What I was going to say is, driving up here, I was listening to the new album, and it's a good 2-hour drive, and I pulled out the hits disc, which I love, and I'm just wondering if you revisit that stuff.
I don't look back.
No, so you.
I had to for hits and misses, to go over everything. But no, I don't go back.
Is there a reason? Because I understand, you know, obviously the creating process and the composition and the creating and moving forward. But I look at music as just a snapshot in time.
Mm-hmm.
And, wow, I'm going through those things. I mean, each song brings back different memories.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think, in terms of creating that stuff, I went back and listened to Both Sides now a few times, and boy, you must have been so young when you wrote that.
It's one of my first songs, 21.
And lyrically, it's so wise. I mean, it brought a tear to my eye today, just thinking about, I've been going through a whole age thing and growing older, and you know, when you're younger, you think you know so much, and then now I'm 38 now, and I realize how little I knew then when I first heard that song. And wondering what you think about it, but...
I think you know everything in a certain way. I think I was kind of fooling myself in my teens, aside from some shyness, you know, like some social awkwardness, you know, which... but that I kind of lost it in my 20s. I kind of broke down. I guess it was like kind of like a breakdown. You come down to nothing. Then you rebuild. And I wanted opinions. Well, I was an opinionated teenager, really opinionated, like doing satire on the beats, and, you know, I would, you know. And a lot of my insights as a teenager, I mean, I feel like I've come full cycle. Like I knew that I was really myself in my teens, and then I lost myself in a certain way with the losing of my child. I mean, that was so traumatic. Mm-hmm. And also, you know, I took a double batch of an extremely powerful Owsley, saw cutting edge physics. You know, saw the vileness of electricity in certain things. It was, so there were certain cosmic revelations that came to me that were disturbing, and caused me to see future difficulties for society. You know, they deepened me in a way that was kind of permanent.
I'm
like,
sorry, what was it that
you did? 2 tabs of Blue Cheer Owsley.
Oh, wow.
You know, like, I took it alone. With my colors out, like ready to do, like kind of a psychedelic masterpiece. Uh-huh. Only time I took acid, the first one didn't work, so I took a double dose. It was one of his most powerful batches, and yeah, I basically saw the luminous. What Hawking talks about is theoretical physics, the luminous fibers that we copied telephone wires and things from. The reason why psychic occurrence. We're wired together. You know, we all, animal, mineral, and vegetable, we're not independent. You know, like we're all suspended in this plasma, you know, and, you know, we're kind of a, you don't really want to know my vision. It was pretty devastating, you know, like and far reaching, and affected my work, deepened it, darkened it, and made me feel kind of like a little like Paul Revere. you know, so, you know, all of that coupled, well, no doubt the universe is unfolding as it should be, you know, says the Desiderata, but it gave me a sense of alarm, like that I knew something about our destiny as a species, kind of like Chicken Little. You know, it was my, since I had been given this vision, that it was my destiny to alarm and warn others, you know, which put me kind of in a peculiar position, considering that up until that time I was kind of a good time Charlie, with a little bit of maladjustment to show business, you know, because it's overwhelming, you know, to be suddenly elevated from the ordinary Joe, have people suck in their breath at the sight of you and all of that. It takes a period of adapting, especially since it's nothing that I wanted. Mm-hmm. You know, some people, that's now their thrill has come, and me, it's like, no, this is all a misunderstanding. You know, so it's taken a long time to get back to now. I feel I'm almost as intelligent as I was when I was 19. You know what I mean?
So the wiseness was there.
Innate. Yeah. I look at my grandson, you know, and there's layers and layers and layers on him. But you know, he said to his mother when he was 3 years old, and I was there, we went, what? You know, well, bad dreams are good in the great plan. You know, so all of that stuff, whenever that is, contact, ability to tap into the big brain that knows everything. Mm-hmm. We all have lesser and greater degrees of ability, you know, to tap into the great brain, the collective, you know, which is where universal wisdom and all of that, that's all of the Eastern pursuits, you know, the meditational pursuits, to increase that ability, I suppose. You know, I can see those traits innate in my grandson, but I also can see, you know, the consumerism and, you know, the too much TV, I want and I want it now, from single parenting, and, you know, all the layers of superficiality and clouding over the depth.
Right, and that comes with society.
Yeah, the very thing that Taming the Tiger is kind of striking out against, only worse because they've latched on to a younger and younger audience. You know, it horrifies me to see him playing these violent, you know, games. I mean, he's sarcastic. He was sarcastic when he was 3 years old, which shows like kind of an intellectual contempt and sense of superiority already. You know what I mean? And all of this is, real life is not cut fast enough for him. And they're all like that, I think.
Yeah.
It's going to be a strange generation, this one coming up. My daughter doesn't like to hear me talk about generations because, you know, for the most part, I see her as a complete individual. But like any generation, she shares some traits. You know, I don't feel that I was particularly typical of my generation, except maybe in terms of costume. You know, I wasn't an anarchist. And I the only hippie value that really attracted me was the Rainbow Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe because I'm a mutt, you know.
I'm sorry to have to cut you off.
This has been just wonderful. I can't thank you enough.
Oh, give me a hug.
Pleasure. And hopefully we can do this on the radio sometime soon.
Oh.
And if I have any say, if the station does happen and yeah. I have any control over it, it will be a lot more like what we talked about than what, you know, KSCA kind of morphed into.
She wanted a hug from me. Oh my God. Listening to that, it was almost 18 years ago that interview was taped. I got to say, again, it was for print. I will post a link to the article that was the product of that interview, which I have not listened to since. And it was every bit as amazing as I remember it. I hope you enjoyed it as I do or did. Wow. Joni Mitchell, get well soon, because I don't even want to think about a world without you. As far as we know, Joni Mitchell remains hospitalized in an L.A. area hospital. Don't know exactly what's going on, but we keep our fingers crossed that she is home soon, maybe back at the little cottage in Laurel Canyon. Wow. What a treat. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did.